I always assumed a stunt double would do the motorcycle work. I break the news to Ron with as much dignity as I can muster, and in a mark of what a great director he will become, he just smiles, reassures me, and figures out another way to shoot the scene. I say my last line, something like, "Let me show you what this baby can do! Out of my way!" And two elderly crewmen, hiding just off camera, attempt to roll me out of frame. It takes forever. Thrills and Chills never made it onto the air. It never made it onto Ron Howard's filmography, either. To my knowledge, the producers didn't even bother to show it to anyone. I've certainly never seen it. And although he's always gracious when we meet, and is one of my favorite directors, I never worked for Ron Howard again. In a way, ABC's after-school specials were ahead of their time. They could definitely be cheesy, but they dealt with taboo issues like drug addiction, anorexia, and teen pregnancy. And they got great ratings. For a brief and shining moment, I was the king of the after-school special. I did a number of them under my ABC contract, the best being Schoolboy Father. In it, I had a baby out of wedlock with the tortured and ill-fated young actress Dana Plato from Different Strokes. I think it won some sort of daytime Emmy Award, although honestly I'm not sure. I've long since dropped it from my resume, mainly because I don't want to be reminded of my David Cassidy hairdo. A night I will never forget was watching Schoolboy Father with my then would-be girlfriend's father. My romance with Corey had fizzled out. I'd set my sights on a stunning, doe-eyed brunette named Jennifer, whom I had met along the beach at the Malibu Colony. My lack of mojo with girls has been fairly well documented in the previous pages, but with some early acting successes and a driver's license to boot, I had upped my game. Nonetheless, I was intimidated. Jennifer attended an elite private school, and her mom, Diane Cannon, starred with Warren Beatty in one of my all-time favorite movies, Heaven Can Wait. Warren Beatty was a hero of mine. Funny, smart, romantic, and great in both comedy and drama. He was the real deal. Jennifer had an on-again, off-again boyfriend who was something of a tough guy idiot. He was just the latest in a string of guys who never cut me any slack, so when he lipped off to Jennifer one day at the Malibu Colony Beach, I lit him up, yelling, "Why don't you shut the fuck up and leave her alone?" The next thing I knew, we were rolling around on the ground and people were pulling us apart. Jennifer must have appreciated the chivalry because when, a few days later, I gathered up my nerve to ask her out, she said yes. It was sort of like a plot from one of my after-school specials. Schoolboy Father was going to air the following week, and Jennifer suggested that I come to her dad's house in Beverly Hills so we could watch it together. I was hoping for Diane Cannon's house, but whatever. The Pacific Coast Highway is always a potential death trap, and as I transition up Sunset Boulevard, I feel a surge of accomplishment. When I make it to Beverly Hills, I look for the prettiest yard I can find, pull over, steal some flowers, and make my way up the winding road to the top of Benedict Canyon to Jennifer's father's house. Cary Grant greets me at the front door in a white terry cloth bathrobe. I have a vague awareness that Jen's father is an old-time movie actor, but I'm ashamed to say that I knew more about Cary Grant from the Flintstones than Cary Grant, the film icon. In my defense, he hadn't made a movie since I was an infant.
"Hello, young man. Jennifer's in her room. Would you like some milk?" he says in his Cary Grant voice.
He leads me through a stunning, white-on-white, modern home with breathtaking views of the city.
"Are you in Jennifer's grade?"
"No, sir. I go to Samohai."
"Ah, well, I see,"
he says, as if making some sort of calculation. We walk into an all-black-and-white kitchen with industrial stainless steel appliances. He grabs two glasses and moves to the single best design feature ever put into a home, a restaurant-style milk dispenser protruding from the front of a gigantic refrigerator. I want to stick my face under it.
"Here you go, young man," he says, filling our cups.
Later, he and Jennifer introduce me to the wonders of shepherd's pie, handmade by Carrie's beautiful young wife, Barbara. It instantly becomes one of my favorite dishes. To this day, I've never had better. Cary and Barbara leave Jennifer and me in private. We talk about our schools and the people we know and laugh, but it's not going to be anything romantic between us. It feels more like a friendship. Soon it's time for the show to air, so we head to the biggest TV in the house, the one in Carrie's bedroom. Jennifer and I sit at the foot of the big bed. I'm still not used to seeing myself on TV, and I'm nervous. Just as the show begins, Carrie pops his head in.
Young man, would you mind if I wash with you?
Not at all, I say, proving unequivocally that ignorance is bliss. And so, the single greatest movie star of all time takes a seat with us to watch a 16-year-old rookie in his first starring role. When the show's over, I'm not quite sure what to think. This sort of reaction continues, only rarely do I know right away how I feel about a finished project. In Cary Grant's bedroom, as the credits roll, no one says a word. Then, finally, from Cary.
Young man, you're quite good. You remind me very much of a young Warren Beatty.
Driving away down his long, winding driveway, I suddenly see him, running down the hill, chasing me in his big, white bathrobe.
Young man! Young man! He calls,
rushing up to my driver's side window.
I thought you might like to have these,
he says, slightly out of breath. His arms are filled with products from Fabergé, where he sits on the board. He fills my car with boxes and boxes of Brute aftershave and soap on a rope. Thank you, Mr. Grant, I say.
Enjoy them,
he says behind those famous big black glasses.
And good luck in the movies. You're going to do great.
As I pull away, I still see him in my rearview mirror, standing along the driveway waving. I keep my soap on a rope in the shape of a microphone for years afterwards. When I learn that someone is doing a remake of the Warren Beatty, Natalie Wood classic, Splendor in the Grass, Cary Grant's words ring in my ears, and I feel I might have some sort of the inside track. It will be a television event starring the biggest young actress on TV, Melissa Gilbert, the star of Little House on the Prairie, and every young actor wants the Warren part. I read for legendary casting director Lynn Stallmaster. I think I rocked it, but by the time I've driven back to Malibu, my agents have called. I didn't get the role. Jesus, I'm the right age, I'm the right look, I had a great audition, I'm perfect for this part. But if I can't even get out of the first round on this, what does it say about my future? When I was in Ohio, I could always go to work in a college production of a good play. But there aren't those options available in Los Angeles. I want to act, not audition. I want to continue to learn my craft. But for now, what I really need is to learn that there is very little rhyme or reason as to who gets what in Hollywood. There are plenty of dedicated, talented actors destined for jobs they hate, chasing in vain a dream that will never come. Soon, I'll have to start thinking about college and possibly reconsider my life's direction. I've had just enough success to keep me chasing the dream, but not enough to ensure a career. I promise myself that I won't be one of the deluded ones, being the last to know that my moment didn't come and that I should have hung it up long ago. I'm going to be 17 soon. Am I already a has-been? Luckily, I've made some great friends despite the time I've spent on my career. Jeff Abrams and I follow Magic Johnson's arrival in L.A. and shoot hoops whenever we can. Jeff's a huge Bjorn Borg fan, while I'm a Connors man. And we spend hours on the tennis court attempting to learn the new topspin forehand. Along with Chris Steenolsen and Josh Kearns, we hang out, steal booze, go to beach parties, and on road trips in Josh's gigantic, hand-painted Road Beast, a 1969 Impala. Good students and serious about school, we're hardly pro-level hellions, but we have some fun. Also in our orbit are the Sheen brothers and the Penns. Chris is still making Nam movies, and Sean is more of an enigma. He's older, into surfing, and getting serious about acting himself. In history class, I bond with a hilarious, madrigal-singing maniac named Robert Downey Jr. No one is funnier or more brilliant at stream-of-consciousness banter. Charlie Sheen is also one of a kind. While his brother is serious and always has his eye on the ball, Charlie, a polo preppy clothes horse in a world of OP shorts and surf t-shirts, is a wonderful mix of nerd. He's a member of the AV club and won't go near the ocean. A rebel, always ready to ditch class to go to a Dodger game and root for our beloved Reds. He is also a conspiracy freak, who sometimes wears a bulletproof vest under his clothes to school, and together we debate everything from the likelihood that the moon is hollow and whether the Trilateral Commission killed JFK to the authenticity of the moon landings. Also, coming from Hollywood royalty, he has all the toys you can imagine. At my house, we're still saving money by not buying desserts. At Charlie's house, its never-ending Häagen-Dazs, brand-new BMWs, a lagoon pool with underwater tunnels, and a lit, professional-grade basketball half-court. I sometimes feel like a bit of an Ohio rube with no toys of my own and no access, like Dodger season tickets, to offer my friends in return for their generosity. But no one seems to care or notice except me. Apparently, there is an amazing part in an upcoming movie that Robert Redford is directing. Emilio is preparing for his audition. I hear the mysterious Sean Penn is also gung-ho about the part. They say the role of Connor in Ordinary People is the kind that changes your life. When I don't even get a meeting on this project, I'm devastated. At a time when all my friends are choosing which college to apply to or finding an easier path into the business than I am, I'm wondering if Hollywood saw what it needed from me and decided I wasn't up to a career of substance or longevity. For the first time since I was an 8-year-old, I start thinking about finding something else to do with my life. Luckily, I've applied to UCLA and USC and have been accepted to both. A kid named Timothy Hutton gets the Redford movie, and it does change his life. He goes from an unknown to an Academy Award winner in 9 months with one shattering performance. Some of my other peers, competitors, are also doing well. Sean Penn is filming a surf high school movie called Fast Times at Ridgemont High, and then we'll team up with Hutton for Taps. I'm unable to get a meeting on either film. Maybe it's time to throw in the towel and be grateful for the amazing adventure I've had. I call my agents to tell them I'll be enrolling at USC and will be unavailable for any further acting roles. They're disappointed, but they understand. When I hang up, I feel the loss of all the possibilities I had hoped would come my way. I thought that if I worked hard enough and believed hard enough, I could will myself into the life I'd wanted for so long. I was wrong. And so I joined the ranks of all other confused, scared 17-year-olds standing on the brink of adulthood, looking into the hazy distance for a navigable road to the future. Then, just after Christmas 1982, my phone rings. My agents are calling with a question. Do you want to give it one last shot? We've gotten you a reading. We think it could be a big movie. It's called The Outsiders. Chapter 9. A vicious winter storm sends driving rain into the streets in front of Francis Ford Coppola's personal movie empire, Zoetrope Studios. Thunder and lightning crackle as I hunker down in my Mazda parked just outside the front gates. In my hand, I have the 5-page scene I will be reading. I have it memorized now, anyone would. This is my 4th audition for The Outsiders. Originally, I met with Janet Hershenson, the casting director who was seeing every male actor in Hollywood between the ages of 15 and 30. She's been good to me in the past, even though I've never gotten a job on her watch. She's always brought me back when she felt I might be right for a part. After I made it past Janet, I read for the film's producer, Fred Roos. Fred cast all of Coppola's early movies, as well as George Lucas's. Among the actors whom Fred would have discovered are Carrie Fisher, Mark Hamill, Harrison Ford, Ron Howard, Richard Dreyfuss, Robert Duvall, Lawrence Fishburne, and Al Pacino. He was intimidating as hell. His face betrayed absolutely no emotion. I didn't know whether he loved me or hated me, but he kept bringing me back. I turned the car radio on. I need to relax. With each level of audition, the pressure is built. I try, but I'm not hearing the music. I'm not even hearing the rain. I look down at the scenes. I look once, twice, then again. Each time I make more mistakes, forgetting lines I knew just hours ago. I look up into the rearview mirror, but I see no reflection. In 5 minutes, I'll be reading for Francis Ford Coppola, and I'm starting to choke. A bunch of 6th graders had the idea to make The Outsiders into a movie. The kids at Lone Pine Elementary School in Central California wrote a letter to the biggest, most famous director they could think of, petitioning him for his services. Although the book was, and is, required reading in middle schools all across the country, Coppola had no idea of its existence, let alone the massive, built-in following of The Outsiders. The book began as a high school English project of a Tulsa teenager, Susie Hinton. She wrote a spare, moving, and authentic story of teen alienation and want of family. Set in the 1950s in the slums of Tulsa and following the orphaned Curtis brothers and their gang of greasers, the book, as well as the movie, was the forerunner to the cultural youth sensations like Harry Potter and Twilight. In fact, when young Susie changed her name to S.E. Hinton in order to hide her gender and to ensure male readers and old male editors that she could handle the subject matter, somewhere in England, a very young Miss Rowling may have taken note. The guard at Zoetrope Studios directs me to stage 5 and hands me a map. Go right on Marlon Brando Way, follow it to Bud Schulberg Avenue, and it's just next to the commissary. I'm wondering why I'm reading on a soundstage and not in an office. I look for a place to park and run through the scene again in my head. My nerves are threatening to unravel all of my preparation. I try to quiet these inner voices that are telling me that my success so far has been nothing but a fluke, but they are gaining strength, and I can feel it. I park the car and jog through the rain to Soundstage 5. I can't believe what I see. There must be 25 other actors huddled under the overhang at the stage door. A lot of them are famous, and some are dressed head to toe in full greaser regalia. Most of them are smoking, and all of them look older than I do. It's like the Screen Actors Guild version of the prison yard, posing, fronting, and intimidation. I look for a friendly face. I see Emilio Estevez, wearing an almost ridiculous-looking pompadour. "Dude, what the fuck is going on?" I ask. A reading for a director is supposed to be a low-key, private meeting. This looks like a public cattle call with every important, young, working actor in the universe. Emilio, ever the old soul, smiles and shakes his head. "Hey, it's Francis." Working for Coppola almost killed Emilio's dad. The stress, the hours, and the heat of making Apocalypse Now had given Martin Sheen a heart attack in his mid-30s. He barely survived, and it changed him. Martin, usually full of life and laughter, was strangely quiet on the subject of all of us competing to work under the great master. In fact, he rarely speaks of Apocalypse Now or Francis at all. But for his sons and their friends, as well as film fans worldwide, it is the stuff of legend. Francis replacing Harvey Keitel, supposedly because the actor bitched about not having a trailer. Martin flying in on a day's notice for a 90-day shoot and staying for 360 days of shooting over the course of 2 years. Brando showing up so fat and bald that they could only shoot him in shadow and making Francis read Heart of Darkness aloud to him in its entirety before he would begin shooting. Hurricanes threatening lives and destroying sets. The Thai military pulling all the jets and helicopters out to quell a coup. Dennis Hopper electing to live and party in the jungle with the natives instead of staying at the hotel. Playboy bunnies being written into the film on a whim and wrecking a marriage or two in the process. Sickness everywhere. A tapeworm poking its head out of Martin's driver's mouth, gagging the man until he pulled the wiggling, pulsing worm out of his own body on the side of the road. Dark tales of stunts gone wrong and actors being asked to do dangerous and reckless things. But to watch Eleanor Coppola's own recollections in her brilliant and frightening documentary Hearts of Darkness is to suspect that some of the legends are true. The stage door opens. Another group of actors emerges from the soundstage. They all look bummed, out of it. One guy, though, has a huge, toothy, wolf-like grin. He whispers to Emilio and me, "Francis set these guys packing, but he asked me to stay." Emilio gives a high five to his buddy, a new young actor from New Jersey, who's been staying at the Sheen's house while he auditions in L.A. "Fucking Francis. I mean, this guy isn't real. I mean, he just sent him away. He just said it right in front of everyone." I start talking to this kid from back east. He's open, friendly, and funny, and has an almost robotic, bloodless focus and intensity that I've never encountered before. His name is Tom Cruise. It will be survival of the fittest for all of us. We will need to intimidate, dominate, and crush our competitors for these roles of a lifetime. But there's no reason we can't try to stay friends while we do it. "What part are you reading for?" I asked Tom. "Christ, up until today it was soda pop, but Francis has everyone switching parts and bringing us all in and out while everybody watches everybody else. I just got done reading Daryl." "But you're not old enough to play Daryl," says Emilio, mildly panicked. "That's what I thought. Plus, I hadn't prepared that part," says Tom. The three of us stand under the overhang, out of the rain, trying to calculate how the various age pairings Coppola is trying will affect our chances. If Daryl, the oldest part in the movie, is played by Tom Cruise, I'm screwed. Okay, next group, says a man, ushering us into the darkness of stage 5. And for the first time, I can hear the blasting sounds of Italian opera. Francis Ford Coppola won his first Oscar in 1971 as the screenwriter for Patton. He then took a dime store pulp novel and, despite countless attempts to have him fired, created The Godfather, giving us Pacino, reintroducing us to Brando, and winning the Oscar for Best Picture. He made its sequel in an era where to do so was considered a shameful, soulless, explicitly commercial folly. Godfather 2 made history by being the only sequel also to win Best Picture, a record that remains to this day. He mentored his young protege, George Lucas, through his breakout American Graffiti after having used George to shoot pickup shots on The Godfather. Like Lucas, Francis deeply distrusted Hollywood and lived and worked in San Francisco, away from the bullshit and the schmooze. And, like Lucas, when massive success came, he created his own personal fiefdom, filled with murderously loyal counterculture artistic geniuses. The Zoetrope Group made its own rules and broke them at will. It was the center of the bullseye in the nexus of artistic achievement, prestige, controversy, and mystery. But as Tom, Emilio, and I take our seats along with the 25 or so others on Stage 5, Zoetrope Studios is fighting for its life. Time magazine has just put Coppola on its cover for a story about the cost overruns on One from the Heart, his latest movie, a groundbreaking special effects musical Meditation starring Nastassja Kinski. Financial power plays are everywhere, with Chase Manhattan Bank threatening to shut Zoetrope down and foreclose on the studio. Francis's artistic, financial high-wire act is the biggest story in the entertainment industry. Our chairs are against the walls of the soundstage. There are too many of us, though, so some actors sit on the ground. The only light is an illuminated area in the center of the floor, which appears to be exactly the size of a boxing arena. A table and 4 chairs have been set up under the light. Just beyond, in the shadows, I see Francis for the first time. He's wearing a beret and fiddling with a state-of-the-art video camera, recording everything. On the table next to him is an old-style record player. My tastes run towards Tom Petty and Bruce Springsteen, so I'm a little foggy on the genre of the extremely emotional Italian music emanating from the turntable. Francis has an assistant with him, and no one else, and she turns down the music. He walks to the edge of the illuminated area and looks out at us. No small talk, no introductions. He gets right to it.
Hi. I thought we'd all get together today and sort of run through things, he says casually, as if auditioning while 30 of your competitors watch is the most normal thing in the world. Some of you may be asked to play different roles than you are prepared to do, and some of you won't. This is really just an opportunity to explore the material, he says mildly.
Explore the material? Is he serious? I look over at Tom Cruise. The only exploring he'll be doing today is to try to find a way to bash my brains in and take my role from me. And from my perspective, right back at him. This may be some abstract artistic experience for Coppola, but for every single one of us young actors huddled in the darkness, this day will be the difference between continuing the struggles of our daily lives and seeing those lives changed forever. Francis points for 3 actors to step into the light.
Say your name into the camera and what role you're reading for, he instructs.
Quietly, I ask the actor next to me how long this has been going on.
I've been here for 5 hours already, he says.
The chosen actors face the Sony prototype video camera, which looks to me like something from the Jetsons. Hi, I'm Dennis Quaid. I'll be playing Daryl.
Hi, I'm Scott Baio. I'll be playing Soda Pop.
I'm Tommy Howell, and I'm Pony Boy.
They take their place around the makeshift kitchen table set. Francis turns up the opera. They start the scene. They're good. Quaid is doing it all from memory, and he's a major guy, so he will be tough to beat. The Tom Howell kid, I've never heard of. He looks like he's a baby and is so low-key it seems like he's not even trying. But he also seems real, and there's nothing forced about his performance. Baio is a huge TV star on Happy Days, so if Coppola wants stars, he's got a shot. He was also terrific in Alan Parker's Bugsy Malone with Jodie Foster. Like everyone else, I'm watching, judging, looking for any edge I can find to help my own audition when I'm finally called. I run through a matrix of possibilities. Do I play it from memory, like Quaid? If I do, Francis may think I'm so prepared that it's a final performance with no room left for improvement or his direction. But by being off book, it also shows nerve, craft, and dedication. Do I stand on it emotionally and really crank up the conflict that's there to be exploited in the writing? Or do I play it understated, withholding something? When great actors do this, like Pacino as Michael Corleone, it's riveting. When lesser actors do it, it's dull. I watch Tommy Howell. It's clear he's in heavy contention for Ponyboy, and he stays in first gear almost the entire time and never pushes. I consider my biggest dilemma, one that every actor at any level struggles with. At the end of my big scene, I have to break down and cry. How much is too much? And behind that unanswerable question is the one that makes any actor's heart stop. What if I can't cry on cue? And that's all it takes. In that one nanosecond of doubt, I feel the blood rush to my head and my chest begin to tighten. I don't know if I can cry during the scene, but I sure as hell could cry right now. In the lit arena, the actors are killing it, knocking it out of the park. When they finish, another group takes over, and then another. No one flames out. No one sucks. It's unheard of to actually sit and watch your competition, and there's a good reason for this protocol. It makes the pressure almost unbearable. I'm getting more unnerved by the minute. An hour goes by. I watch a stream of the elite enter the set, the guy who starred in Caddyshack, the blonde kid from On Golden Pond. A young actor with big teeth and curly hair reads Ponyboy. People are buzzing about the super-secret movie he stars in about to come out with Steven Spielberg directing, called E.T. I look over at Tommy Howell to see his reaction to this guy's reading. Tommy is stone-faced, cool as ice. How old is that kid? I ask Emilio. Tommy Howell? 15. There's a commotion at the stage door. The storm has stopped, the sun's come out, and its blinding light streams in as a man dressed like a homeless person enters. He has long, filthy hair, a three-day beard, and ripped, stained, Mad Max-like leather pants. He's also on roller skates. Francis makes a beeline for him, and they huddle in the corner. The other actors point and whisper. That's Mickey Rourke, says one of them. Who? I ask. I've never heard of the guy. But he's being worshipped like he's the love child of Laurence Olivier and Jesus Christ. He's the next James Dean, someone says. All around, there are nods in agreement. Really? I say, looking him over. He sure as shit looked a lot better in Rebel Without a Cause. We all chuckle quietly, beginning to bond over being thrown together in this extraordinary pressure cooker. It's getting late, nearing 4 o'clock p.m., and I've been waiting and watching for hours. Francis seems to be tiring. He no longer swaps guys in and out like hockey players changing lines on the fly. Now he's reading names off a list. Rob Lowe? Is Rob Lowe here? He asks, squinting into the darkness. Adrenaline explodes in my chest. Yes, hello, I'm here. You're playing Soda Pop, he says without looking at me. I walk into the glare of the lights. I'm blinking, trying to focus. I've been sitting in the dark too long. I'm disoriented. I can't see Francis or the camera or the other actors watching, but I can feel them, just beyond the light, compressed into an omnipresent being. My heart is a jackhammer. It sounds like someone is running up a flight of stairs in my head. Something is wrong. I remember the problem. I've forgotten to breathe. I try to exhale slowly so no one sees me do it. I've got to mask my discomfort and cover my nerves at all costs. The other actors gather around me. Tom Howell is Ponyboy, and a guy named John Laughlin from An Officer and a Gentleman will play our older brother, Daryl. Why don't you guys take a moment and then begin when you're ready, says Francis. I've got the first line of the scene, so it will be up to me when we go. I look the other actors in the eyes. We've never met, never even said hello. Now we will be the Curtis brothers. Now we will manufacture the memories, the relationships, and the rapport of these characters' lifetimes in an instant. I've got my pages in my hand. They've been there since I sat in my Mazda in the rain. But I let them fall to the floor. I will go from memory. Let the chips fall where they may. I know this fucker cold. I won't let fear overtake me. Not now. Not today. I say a quick prayer. Keep it simple. Keep it honest.
let it rip. I start the scene. I've never agreed with the conventional wisdom that actors are great liars. If more people understood the acting process, the goal of good actors, the conventional wisdom would be actors are terrible liars, because only bad actors lie on the job. The good ones hate fakery and avoid manufactured emotion at all costs. Any script is enough of a lie anyway. What experience does any actor have with flying a spacecraft, killing someone? What's called for, what actors are hired for, is to bring reality to the arbitrary. I know nothing about being an orphan. I wasn't alive in the 1950s. I've never been to Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I've never met a greaser. But I do have brothers whom I love. I know what it means to long for a parent who is no longer in the family. I have met my share of rough kids and felt that I didn't belong. And when I remember my gang of old friends back on Dayton's north side, my personal truths provide enough emotional ammunition to play Soda Pop Curtis. Like a skater approaching the point in his program where he has to land a triple axel jump, I know the moment for my big breakdown is coming up fast. I'm trying to stay in the scene, not stand outside of it, up in some corner looking down in judgment like some character in an episode of Bewitched. But part of me can't help it. The stakes are too great, and I know if I don't land this jump, I mean really stick it, this audition is over. And with it, practically, my career as an actor. I hate it when you two fight, I say, beginning the final speech. It just tears me up inside. I look at Tommy Howell. I don't know him from Adam, but I see his eyes are moist. And that's all I need. That tiny peek at humanity and empathy from a 15-year-old stranger. It sets me off. Behind it, the pressure and the nerves and the stakes and the need to be liked and accepted and chosen build into a wave that I couldn't control if I wanted to. The emotions explode. At the end of the scene, Howell and Laughlin and I are huddled in the glare. They are holding me as I weep. After the audition, I hear nothing for weeks. No phone call comes into my agents. I know I shellacked it in my reading, but after Francis sent the other actors back to the shadows and asked me to stay to read a different part, the role of Randy the Soche, and it's pronounced Soche, more than a few of their actors had their tickets punched by calling them socks, and it's a small part with one big speech, and I can see where physically I would be right for it, but I pray that I'm still in the running for Soda Pop. Other than Pony Boy, Soda Pop is the most coveted role in the movie. The part is huge, romantic, and with the big breakdown scene at the end of the movie, unforgettable. I'm worried I've lost it. I spend all my free time four houses down at the Sheens. Cruz is still camping out in the guest bedroom, but neither he nor Emilio have heard about their auditions either. We work out, play hoops, call our agents, call up girls, hide booze from Martin, hit baseballs with Chad and Charlie, and try anything to not lose our minds with anticipation. I've settled on USC as my college. If I don't get the part, I will enroll and study film. I've been toying with following my dad into law or pursuing marine biology, but in the end, my heart is stuck on reaching people with stories on film. If I can't be in front of the camera, I'll be behind it. Finally, my agent calls. Do I have the part? No. My heart sinks. But they want you to fly to New York and read again. I can feel the blood coming back to my face. I'm still alive in the outsider's sweepstakes. What part am I reading? Soda or Randy? I ask, holding my breath. Both. I try not to be disappointed that Randy is still an option. Pack up. You leave day after tomorrow. I put the phone down. It rings in my hand. It's Emilio.
Dude, did they call you? Are you going to New York?
Yes, I made it. What about you?
We're going too.
Me and Cruz.
What parts?
I'm going for Randy, Soda, and maybe Daryl, depending on the ages, says Emilio.
What about Cruz? I ask.
Soda, Randy, Daryl, and Dallas.
Holy shit, I say.
This thing is clearly still a wide-open free-for-all. I hang up, excited that my friends are among the chosen. We are competitors, and it is likely it will come down to one of us versus the other. And if it does, we will try to blow each other out of the water with zero regrets on all sides. But until then, it's down to the Sheen's Gilligan's Island pool to celebrate.
On the plane, we sit together with the two other LA finalists, Tommy Howell and Darren Dolphin. Together, we talk to try to predict who will get what role. We also find a cute stewardess and work her relentlessly for alcohol. It's a night flight with a lot of empty seats, so it feels like we own the plane. By the time we land, we are connected, like a less dangerous teenage show business version of the Dirty Dozen. We are all thrown together by fate, required to work together to achieve a goal that will be the highlight of our lives. Along the way, any one of us could fall. You don't want it to be you, but you don't want it to be your new brother either. There is also a group waiting to knock us out entirely, the New York actors. Their reputations precede them. Tough, intense, serious, hard cases. We make our plan to battle them, to come out of this together, leaving the others in the dust. We are the LA Greasers. After surviving the 3-day, 30-hour battle of Zoetrope Studios, we feel like Hollywood's finest. We check into the Plaza Hotel. I'm taken aback at the luxury and spectacle of the lobby. The last time I was in New York, Dad and I stayed at the Sheraton. The front desk tells us we will be sharing rooms. In a flash, Cruz is on the phone to his agent, Paula Wagner. Paula, they are making us share, he says. He is certain that this is not right, and he wants it fixed ASAP. The rest of us are staggering around like happy goofs, but this guy is already showing the traits that will make him famous. He's zeroed in like a laser, all business, and very intense. Okay, then. Thank you very much, he says, like a 50-year-old businessman getting off the phone with his stockbroker. Paula says it's fine. After sorting out our rooms, we decide to pile into a cab and check out the sights. 42nd Street, someone says. The cabbie's eyes widen as he turns to look at the group squeezed into his back seat. A 15-year-old, a 17-year-old, and the three adults weighing in at around 19 years old. You boys sure you want to go down there? Ain't nothing but women and trouble to be found down there. Yes, we're sure. We howl and laugh, banging on the plexiglass divider like animals. We are all seriously dragging the next morning as we arrive at Zoetrope East. Any effects of our long night are mitigated by the growing tensions of the East Coast versus West Coast acting brawl that is moments away. This time, the auditions are called what they actually are, screen tests. And unlike the auditions in L.A., the group from New York is much more select, maybe 15 guys in total. We lounge together in a giant loft-like waiting area in some dingy office building somewhere near Broadway. I'm freezing. Having little travel experience, I've not packed correctly for the New York winter. It doesn't help that I'm jet-lagged and hungover. I find a spot on the floor next to the radiator to take a nap. To this day, when I feel too much stress, I always want to fall asleep. Dude, wake up, says Emilio, banging me in the ribs. I try to clear my head as I roll up off the floor. Francis wants us in the studio. It's a small, hot space. The basic setup is exactly like L.A., except for, inexplicably, Carly Simon wearing some sort of cat suit curled up in a corner. I also recognize Matt Dillon, already a huge teen idol and the star of S.E. Hinton's first movie adaptation, Tex. It hasn't come out yet, but he's supposed to be very good. Matt is in front of the camera reading the part of Dallas. And by reading, I mean reading. He's holding the entire script, his eyes locked on the text. After a while, however, he puts it down and begins paraphrasing. Soon, he's ad-libbing and completely making up dialogue while all the other actors try to keep up. I don't know if Francis asked him to freelance like this or not. If he did, then clearly Matt Dillon has this part locked up. If he didn't, then Matt Dillon has dangling, clanking, scary big elephant balls. Next up is a tiny kid I competed against a few months back for a part on the hit TV show 8 is Enough. It came down to the two of us for a new starring role that they were adding to the show. We both went to the network reading in a boardroom packed with stone-faced executives in business suits. He came out on top. Now he's reading for the part of Johnny, the tortured, doomed greaser. Like Tommy Howell, it's clear he's the frontrunner. When he's done, I call over to him. Ralph! Hey, Machio! It's me, Lo. Ralph comes over to say hi. Hey, man, it's good to see ya. How many times have you read for this? I ask. A lot. Matt and I have been doing this for days. Have you read for any other parts? Nope. Just Johnny. Matt, too. Just Dallas. I see Francis looking around the room. Rob?
Rob, can you come read the part of Randy?
This is what I was afraid of. I feel like I might pass out.
Sure, no problem, I manage.
I quickly look over the scene. If I do well now as Randy, Francis may want me for that part, opening up Soda to one of the other finalists who has been on the periphery until now, like Tom Cruise. Maybe I should tank the reading, I think briefly, but knowing I'm incapable of it. I finish playing the scene at full throttle. I'm praying I don't get this part. No one wants to be a soche in a movie about greasers. It's 110 degrees in the sweatbox of a studio as Tom Cruise is called to the floor. Now I have real issues. He's giving my role a try. He begins Soda Pop's big breakdown scene at the end of the movie. I watch him and think, that's it, I'm done. He's clearly a force to be reckoned with and is more focused and ambitious than I ever thought about being. And that's saying something. But then, Tom has stopped. Stop the scene. Right in the middle of the monologue. A hush falls over the room. I'm sorry. I'm really sorry here, he says, looking directly at Francis. This just isn't working for me. Holy shit, not working for him. I thought Francis Ford Coppola was the judge of what works and what doesn't. There is a low murmur among the actors. Francis lets him try again. But when he's done, I know the cruise missile threat has passed.
Rob, give Soda a try, please, Francis asks blithely.
But I know that right now, right here, in this moment, a life-changing part is mine for the taking. What Francis is really asking is, Rob, do you want this part? I do the scene and crush it. The answer is yes. Yes, I do.
Chapter 10. A suspenseful 2 weeks later, it's official. I'm offered the part of Soda Pop Curtis, the romantic, sweet-natured, loving middle brother. Tommy Howell surprises no one by getting the lead role of Ponyboy, and Matt Dillon fulfills expectations by getting the role of the tough hood Dallas. My instincts proved right about Ralph Macchio. He will play the tragic mascot Johnny. The other roles remain uncast. I'm elated. It doesn't seem real. I'm going to make a movie. And in my first movie, I will have one of the starring roles. And my first director will be one of the greatest who ever lived. And not only did I survive one of the longest, most competitive casting searches in years, I was one of the first ones to be cast. I celebrate with my family. I contact USC and I tell them I won't be enrolling. I start to think about what it will be like to be away from home, on my own for the first time while we shoot on location in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I also am anxious for my new brothers-in-arms, Emilio and Tom, and the others with whom I bonded over the last few months. They are all still hoping to get one of the remaining roles, but so far, they've heard nothing. I have no idea what to expect. My apprehension is probably similar to what any 17-year-old feels as he packs for freshman year at college. But in that case, you could ask your dad, what do I need to know? What advice do you have? And dad tells you. But obviously, I can't do that. No one in my family has any experience in this new world. So I walk down to the Sheen's house, looking for Martin. We crack open the vanilla Haagen-Dazs, and I ask him every question I can think of. He is gracious and patient. I am vulnerable and a little scared, but excited. By the time we finish our ice cream, I feel more prepared for what I might encounter. I thank him. At the door, he stops me. One last thing. Sure, Martin, what is it? Don't let Francis make you do anything you're uncomfortable with. I consider that last unsettling piece of advice as I jog back home through the gathering fog to pack. I am on the cusp of something, and I feel a mixture of emotions. I'm proud, scared, cocky, insecure, anxious, and confident all at once. And truth be told, after the long, adrenaline-filled audition process, I'm also feeling a little down. I will later learn that this is a hallmark of alcoholism. We call it the Peggy Lee syndrome. You reach a goal you've been striving for only to feel, is that all there is? If I'm going to make a career out of this, I will have to sort myself out. My bare feet are hurting slightly as I trot down the driveway. Chad and Micah are playing horse, and my mom is calling us into the house for dinner. A wave of homesickness rises up, but I haven't even packed a suitcase. Looking down, I notice a tiny cut with some blood on my right foot, and I realize I'm going to have to build up my calluses.
There are giant praying hands outside my airplane as it descends into Tulsa, Oklahoma. The massive sculpture from Oral Roberts University seems to be sending me a message. My future is at hand. It is unknowable. It is an adventure. I don't know where it will all lead. I might as well pray. I'm flying alone. Tom and Emilio were offered parts at the last minute and are driving out in Emilio's pickup. Tom is playing my best friend Steve, and Emil, Two-Bit Matthews, another of the Curtis's circle of friends. The Sheen's family's complicated history with Francis runs so deep that before he accepted the role, Emil literally put the script under his mattress and slept on it before finally saying yes. The plane comes in for a bumpy landing on an early spring afternoon in the beginning of March 1982. It's 2 weeks before my 18th birthday. The Tulsa Excelsior sits smack in the middle of downtown. This will be my home for the next 10 weeks. At the front desk, I'm handed a new shooting script, crew list, an envelope with a wad of cash, per diem, and a key to room 625. You are right next door to Tommy Howell and across the hall from Mr. Macchio. "Welcome to Tulsa," the man says at the desk counter. I look up and recognize Diane Lane coming through the revolving door of the lobby. At only 16, she already seems like a legend. She's starred with Laurence Olivier and been on the cover of Time magazine. Oh, and she may be the prettiest girl on the planet. She will play Cherry Valance, the Queen Soche. Too shy to introduce myself, I watch as she breezes by with her chaperone. And with all the teen testosterone in this movie, she'll need one. I head up to my room, which is very plain and simple, a desk, a small refrigerator, and two twin beds. But to me, it's the greatest setup I've ever seen. It's like my first apartment, and in fact, it is. I'm out of the house, away from my parents, living on my own, and because I'll be 18 in a week or two, for the first time, I have no guardian. This new sense of freedom is powerful enough to knock me to my knees, right here in room 625. "Hey man, is that you?" I recognize Tommy Howell's voice as he unlatches the door to our adjoining rooms. "We did it!" I yelp, and we hug in celebration. "Man, I'm so glad you got soda," he says. "Thanks, man. Who's with you? Do you have a guardian?" I ask Tommy. "No, it's just me." I'm a little taken aback. Tommy is just 15, but I ask no questions. "Put your shirt on. Let's go eat," he says. I throw my suitcase into the corner, and we head for the elevators. It stops on the fifth floor. "Hey, guys," says Darren Dalton, a tall kid who got the part I was praying I wouldn't, Randy the Soche. "Why aren't you on our floor?" I ask. "Dude, our floor is for Soches only. We have these amazing suites, free room service, gym privileges. It's so cool." "Yeah, Francis wants us segregated," Tommy informs me. "He's given him more per diem, better rooms, and all these embossed leather script binders." "Ah, I see. He's trying to create a class system on the set, trying to make us greasers jealous," I say. "Well, it ain't working," cackles Tommy. "If anybody's jealous, it's them about us, since the greasers are the fucking stars of the movie." Tommy and I laugh and high-five, busting Darren's balls. On The Outsiders, ball-busting will become a fine art. Coming back from dinner, we come upon an amazing spectacle. There must be 50 girls around our age congregating around the Excelsior lobby. I remember the body language and the low-level hysteria from being mobbed in Riverside, and I recognize them at once as fans. But of whom? At that moment, Matt Dillon saunters past, and the girls sway en masse like willows in a spring breeze. "Oh, May, what's shaking?" asks Matt in his patented, laconic, cool guy fashion. It's a little hard to hear him as he's carrying a gigantic boombox that's playing some obscure song by T-Rex. None of us really know Matt well. We are the L.A. group, after all, and he is the embodiment of the New York actor. He's already well-established as a fledgling matinee idol and, more important, has Tulsa wired from starring in his first movie, Tex, which he shot here 6 months ago. He knows the rub on all levels. We had crossed paths in New York at the auditions, but now we make our introductions in earnest. Matt is funny, wry, and has the sort of jaded charisma that none of us possess. As we talk, the girls twitter and whisper in the background.
"Ah, man, I'm tired. See you at rehearsals," he says, hoisting his boombox to his shoulders.
He crosses to the elevators and passes the gaggle of fans. Then something remarkable happens. He stops dead in his tracks and whispers to a pretty brunette. She listens for a beat and then turns to the four girls she's standing with and whispers something to them. Matt fiddles with the volume of the boombox. The girls caucus together for a total of about 4 seconds, till the brunette leaves her friends behind and joins Matt for a walk to the elevators. He puts his free arm around her. At the last second, just before they enter the elevators, she turns back to look at her friends. Her expression is one I have never seen before. It's like she has a thought balloon over her head and it reads, "Holy shit, how lucky am I?" Matt yawns and the elevator doors close. The entire transaction takes less than 45 seconds. So that's how it is, I think, and take note. Matt fucking Dillon, my hero. Rehearsals begin the next morning in an abandoned elementary school. The classrooms are used as the film's production offices. The auditorium gymnasium is our rehearsal space. I've never rehearsed anything but a play, and there is no real rehearsal in television. Since we are playing two of the three brothers at the center of the film, Tommy Howell and I are already beginning to connect in a way that will hopefully pay off emotionally later when we need it in our performances. We stand in the corner of the musty, dirty gym with Tom and Emilio, who've pulled an all-nighter driving from Point Doom. "Who's playing Daryl?" asks Cruz, who has auditioned for that part of the eldest Curtis brother. "We still don't know," says Howell. "It's been a bit of a soap opera, this search for the last actor in the Outsiders puzzle." "I heard they offered it to Mickey Rourke, but he turned it down," says Emilio. "I heard he turned down all the parts," says Ralph Macchio. Someone proffers up a tidbit that Fred Roos has pulled the casting rabbit out of the hat by finding an actor who never auditioned with us in L.A., a much older guy who did a movie where he danced around on roller skates. "What's the guy's name?" I ask. "Patrick Swayze," says Emilio. Minus the mysterious Mr. Swayze, who will arrive later, the entire cast begins what will end up being over 2 full weeks of rehearsals. Only years later will I learn that this lengthy, luxurious warm-up was due to the movie's funding collapsing. While behind the scenes, the future of The Outsiders hung in the balance, we blithely submitted to France's unique methods of preparation. On the first day, we read through the script, get haircuts, and have wardrobe fittings. We cut off early, as Francis wants us up by 8:30 in the morning for a meeting at the house we will use as the main set. The next day, we pile into vans and are driven into the run-down, desolate neighborhood where 80% of the movie will be shot. When we arrive at the small, beat-up, two-bedroom home that will be used as the Curtis brothers' house, Francis stands in the weed-filled dirt yard waiting. "Hi, guys. Gather round," he says in his relaxed, earnest, and brainy way. Sometimes Francis sounds a little like Kermit the Frog, but with a deeper register. "I want us to meet on this spot where we will work and be together. I feel like we should do this every day. And now I would like us all to begin our day with a half hour of Tai Chi," he says. I don't know what Tai Chi is. I look around for a delivery man. Maybe it's some sort of Asian takeout, which would be great because I'm starving. But as I scan the horizon, I see it's just us, Francis and his greasers, standing around in the dirt. Francis begins swaying and gesticulating in slow motion, almost like he's underwater. "Tai Chi is the art of energy transformation," he says. "It builds concentration, strength, and balance. It puts your body in harmony with its environment." We all form a line and begin to follow his movements. And that's when I recognize the motions as the ones Martin Sheen did in front of the mirror at the beginning of Apocalypse Now. As the exercises drag on, I think, Martin's character was in Saigon. My character's in Tulsa. How does a 50s greaser know or care about Tai Chi? But if the world's greatest living director thinks we should stand on our heads to prepare, we should probably do so. Patrick Swayze arrives in time for the next day's rehearsal. He walks into the gym as cool as you want, wearing tight jeans and a tattered, sleeveless Harley Davidson t-shirt, revealing his massive, ripped arms. This is his uniform. He never changes it. And if I looked like him, neither would I. "Hi, I'm Buddy," he says, squeezing my hand with such enthusiasm that I thought it would snap like a twig. This guy is yoked. I mean, he is literally made of iron. He is very high-strung, amped, ready to storm the battlements at the drop of a hat. He's a Texan, with legitimate drawl, so he's a great arbiter of our oaky accents. Buddy is also a decade older than the rest of us, and married, so on that level, he might as well have been a Martian. That, too, serves him well as the older brother Daryl, who is farther down life's road. "Hey, guys, I had a notion that you are all acrobats," says Francis, entering the gym and sipping an espresso. "In fact, I'd like you all to go down the hall for some training." he says, heading over to greet Swayze.
You bet. Yahoo!
Hoots Swayze, clapping his hands and yelping like a wolf. I love his enthusiasm. He makes Tom Cruise look lobotomized. The seven greasers file down the hall to a classroom that's been turned into a rudimentary tumbling area. There are parallel bars, rings, and a trampoline. The only thing missing are safety mats. Instead, someone has placed a bunch of 2x4 squares of styrofoam on the floor. Swayze immediately takes charge.
I was a gymnast in high school, he informs us.
His list of previous accomplishments will grow to include ballet dancer, bow and arrow specialist, motocross expert, horseman, guitar player, singer, songwriter, construction worker, carpenter, and artist, to name a few. Along with a local guy from the University of Tulsa, he begins to teach us the standing backflip. Now, I am one of those guys who loves sports and the adrenaline rush of a physical challenge, but when it comes to flips, I'm a pussy. I do not flip. I don't even dive into a pool. Straight cannonball for me. The thought of falling mid-flip to the ground conjures up images of rolling around in a wheelchair like Raymond Burr in Ironside. No thanks. Cruz, not surprisingly, is all over it.
How about this?
He says, almost pulling it off without even being spotted. He wipes out, but tries it again immediately. Now Howell and Emilio have their blood up. They don't want to be upstaged, so they begin digging in earnest. Splat, one goes down. Funk, another hits the deck, making the sound of a side of beef hitting the pavement. Eventually, some of the guys figure it out, and then, mercifully, it's time for our assignments back in the rehearsal hall. Francis tells us that we will be shooting the entire movie on video, in front of a green screen in the gym, before we begin real principal photography. Later, he can use new Sony technology to put in any background he chooses. But before we shoot, he asks us to do a lengthy improvisational exercise that culminates with us attempting to go to sleep on camera. Now, this I can do. When it comes to sleeping, I should be in the goddamn Olympics.
Very good job, Rob, he says,
and I'm thrilled. Diane Lane and the other Sochs, led by teen idol Leif Garrett, arrive to do the big drive-in scene. The minute Diane enters the room, a competition for her attention commences. Matt Dillon clearly has the inside track, and soon we all know that we have no chance. Francis appears to dote on Matt as well. He's clearly grooming him to be the James Dean of the movie. For his part, Leif Garrett has embraced Francis's attempt at class warfare. We all like Leif. He's so jaded from his years as a teen cover boy that he's hilarious. But he is determined to be superior to us, just like his character Bob would be. This, of course, leads to a merciless ball busting. One day, all the greasers pose for a photo shoot in full costume in the shitty gym. Leif comes to watch. The local kids have been running roughshod through the production offices for days, stealing anything they can get their hands on. This really is a horribly poor part of Tulsa, and who can blame them? And we're all posed together under the flashing strobe as a production assistant finally goes off and drags a local ragamuffin away for pilfering the candy bars and other goodies that are laid out just off the set. Keep your goddamn hands off the food. It's not for you. It's for the actors, the assistant yells. Yeah, Leif, you hear that? Calls Machio to Leif, who is standing by the snack table. Those are for the actors. Garrett is mortified. A hush falls over the room until we all burst out laughing. I look over, cracking up at Ralph, who now looks a little scared. Flash, snap, the camera captures the moment. That frame of film will become the poster for the outsiders. That night, we are divided into groups and sent out to spend the night with real greasers. And when I say spend the night, I don't mean have a long dinner and hear some stories. We are meant to sleep at their houses. Now, I had always hated overnights with kids I didn't know very well. So the thought of bunking with Hell's Angels that some production assistant found off the street has got me rattled. What are the odds that they could be murderers? I ask Tommy Howell. Francis has chosen Tom Cruise as my roommate for this adventure. He and I are delivered like two sacks of mail to a slightly tired-looking duplex outside of town. Tom's unrelenting enthusiasm for anything, however ridiculous, plus a few hours to calculate the mathematical improbability that these folks are axe murderers, has me kind of intrigued about this experiment. We are greeted at the door by a middle-aged couple.
You boys must be the actors,
says the man, offering his hand. He is almost fully tattooed.
Yes, sir. I'm Tom Cruise.
Hi, I'm Rob Lowe.
Well, come on in, boys, says the woman, who looks like any other Midwestern housewife.
Clearly, my darker fears were unfounded, as this couple could not be more welcoming. We share dinner in the tiny kitchen and swap stories about our lives, as young actors in Hollywood with their stories of being greasers in the mid-50s in Tulsa.
We talk until late into the night, until everyone tires. "Well, boys, I better tuck you in for the night," says the woman, leading us to a fold-out bed that Tom and I will share. "Thanks so much, ma'am," says Cruz, who is always unrelentingly polite and formal with adults or anyone of authority. "I'll see you in the morning," I add.
"You betcha," she says, shutting out the light.
Cruz and I lie there on the bumpy cot, saying nothing. Neither wants to disturb the other's chance of actually falling asleep in this bizarre circumstance. I'm trying to assimilate all of the information, experiences, and lessons that are hitting me every day like crashing waves. I've made it to this point in my life on instinct and hard work. But after a few days on the Outsiders, I know I have so much to learn, and for once, my mind won't let me sleep. I know I'm hardly alone. Other than Matt Dillon and Diane Lane, all of us are just getting started in movies. But I'm competitive, and if anyone is going to come out of this most ready for the future, I want it to be me. Oddly enough, there's something comforting in knowing that my cotmate feels exactly the same way.
"Cruz. Cruz. You awake?"
I whisper.
"Yeah, man," he says.
"Me too,"
I say, as we both stare at the ceiling, waiting for tomorrow and what will come next. In keeping with the theme of toughening us up and having us interact with the genuine articles, the next morning finds us gathered to play some local tough guys in a game of tackle football on cement. I huddle up the greasers. I am in my element. Back in Ohio, I spent countless days like these drawing out button hooks and go routes with my gang of North Dayton toughs. Our opposition is really no different, although I am a tad unsettled by my suspicion that some of them wouldn't mind sending a Hollywood actor to the hospital. I look at Team Greaser. Clearly, I'm going to have an issue with Dillon. He has the boombox playing Bowie and is wearing his ever-present motorcycle boots. He yawns and scratches his chest. I know a blocker when I see one. "Matt, play line," I say.
"Cool, man,"
he replies, lighting a Marlboro. Machio is so tiny, I have to hide him somewhere as well. Cruz and Emilio are fast as hell and gung-ho, so they'll be receivers. Swayze, of course, wants to play all positions and probably could.
"Hey, Soda," he says, calling me by my character's name. "See that big dude with a goatee? I'm going to knock his block off on the first play."
He's got a look in his eye that I will come to know well, and I figure I better let him do what he wants.
"Go for it, man."
Tommy Howell has been walking the parking lot, kicking away rocks, and otherwise just sort of checking out our playing field. Being the son of a longtime Hollywood stuntman, Tommy is evaluating the risk-reward equation of the matter at hand. "I think these guys want to hurt us," he says.
"Me too," I answer. He looks at me like, how the hell did we end up in this situation?
But we take our positions, hoping for the best.
"Red Rover! Red Rover! 32! 32! Hut! Hut!"
I bark, doing my best Terry Bradshaw. Cruz and Emilio blow their guys out of their shoes. Emilio was a track god at Malibu Park and hasn't lost a step. But the Tulsa tough guys have blitzed, decimating my line of Dillon, Howell, and Machio. Swayze, however, has totally shit-canned his man, who lies on the ground wiggling like a fish. I'm forced to roll out. I look for my receivers, but there are guys in my face. Someone hammers me from the blind side, and I'm down, hard. The greasers return to the huddle.
"Man, that was fucked up," says Dillon lazily.
"You gotta listen to me. I'm telling you, when I was growing up in Texas, I played a guy who..."
begins Swayze with a vintage story about his youth and Pop Warner football. I can't follow the rest because I'm trying to clear my head.
"Let's just all go along," interrupts Cruz, calling the play universally reserved for teams who are desperate.
"Old Yeller! Old Yeller! Hut! Hut!"
Everybody goes long. Everybody gets knocked silly. The Tulsa hoods try to hide their satisfaction at the beatdown.
"You almost had us on that one," says the one in the Levi cutoffs.
We attempt to regroup in the huddle.
"Okay, I'm taking over here," says Swayze, wild-eyed.
"No, no, no. No, you're not," says 15-year-old Tommy Howell. His tone and earnest demeanor have us all listening. These guys are looking for a story to tell their girlfriends.
"Honey, you should have seen it. We popped those Hollywood actors good.
Well, that is not going to happen on my watch. I'm done. I quit. Because if I break a leg doing this, I am out of this movie in 2 seconds and on the next flight home. And I am not going to lose this part over a stupid fucking exercise. It's over. Francis can fire me if he wants to," he says, walking away. We all look at each other. There's no denying his logic.
"Hey guys, we forfeit. Congrats. Great game," I say.
If there is any dissent among the rest of Team Greaser, no one says anything. The Tulsa Roughnecks look stunned as we clear out, but they, too, say nothing. As we pile into our van to drive away, I think I can hear them laughing at us. I'm sure they thought we were just a bunch of scared Hollywood pansies. On the night before principal photography, Francis has one last task for us. He wants the three Curtis brothers to spend the night at the house we will be shooting in and to do a marathon improv session. He will observe with Outsider's author, S.E. Hinton. Swayze, Howell, and I are petrified. It's one thing to improv a scene or two, but to do hours of it? In front of the director and the author? Back in the van, we huddle together, working out a framework. We decide that we should cook dinner, figuring that that will eat up a lot of clock and give us something to talk about as well. Problematically, neither Tommy nor I can boil an egg, but, as usual, Swayze has experience in the field. "I'll cook us a steak. You two make the salad," he says. Later that afternoon, we gather at the house. Francis and S.E. Hinton sit on the couch in the living room, saying nothing, just observing. S.E., or Susie, as she is called, has become our den mother. She's a firecracker, smart, sarcastic, a real guy's gal. All the greasers love her, and we should. She created us. Now she watches her Curtis brothers cooking in the tiny rundown kitchen. This improv will later be incorporated into the film as Pony Boy makes a breakfast of a chocolate cake. Tommy, Swayze, and I laugh, bicker, and banter like brothers. Francis seems pleased. As the evening wears on, we run out of inspiration, and Swayze bails us out again by pulling out his sixth string. The three of us break our 1950s timeline to sing Springsteen songs until late into the night. Eventually, Francis has seen enough.
"Okay, guys, that's it for now. If you'd rather sleep back at the hotel, maybe that's best."
Relief washes over us. We pile into the van and head back to the comparative luxury of the Tulsa Excelsior. On the ride, Francis tells stories about shooting Apocalypse Now and Patton. I'm hoping to hear more, to hear about The Godfather and Pacino, or what's going on with One from the Heart or any of the other extraordinary chapters of his great life. But we've arrived at the hotel.
"Break a leg tomorrow, boys," Francis says. "See you on the set."
Some actors take acting classes. Some go to schools of drama like Yale and Juilliard. Not me. I learned on the job. And my most influential teacher was Coppola. His lengthy, sometimes bizarre, rehearsal process for The Outsiders was my most memorable course. I learned more about preparing a character, how they walk, talk, dress, eat, and sleep, in those 2 weeks than I probably would have learned in 2 years elsewhere. It also happened at the perfect time, the end of my senior year in high school. Just like any kid about to go to college begins to think seriously about how they want to earn a living, I was learning the tools of my trade and being paid to do it. There were days when I would have liked to have faced lower expectations and less pressure than learning at this particular level demanded. It's much easier to expose yourself, to take chances, and to allow yourself to fall on your face when you're not being groomed for a Warner Brothers spring release. Crashing and burning in an elite private acting class would have been a very different experience, and part of me envied those who were schooled in that fashion. But that was not my path. Having a movie or two to warm up in small roles while I got my feet wet might have had an advantage or two, but let's face it, it's good to be a lead. But as I sat in the makeup chair before our first shot on our first day of shooting, I was completely unprepared for the intensity of what was to come. Like all the greasers, I had chosen a uniform for my character, one that will be very different from the seven others and equally identifiable in the many group shots the movie will require. This is an important lesson whenever you're working in an ensemble. Be unique, be noticed, but never do it in a way that is showy or attempts to pull focus in a dishonest way. I'm in my black work boots. They're heavy. They'll make me walk slow and plodding. My white t-shirt and an open flannel shirt over it. My collar's up. My hair is slicked back. I am in awe of Emilio's bold choice for his look. He will wear a Mickey Mouse t-shirt throughout the movie. Francis likes it so much that not only does he pay Disney exorbitant rights so Emil can wear the character on his shirt, he writes a scene where we all watch Mickey on TV. That's how you make a mark. Make a strong choice for your character, and if it works, you never know where it will lead. And indeed, Emilio's relentless ad-libbing and ideas took a peripheral character and made it a focal point. My first shot in the movie has all of us together in the dirty yard where we practice Tai Chi. Ponyboy has been beaten up by the rich kids, and we rush to the alley to save him. As the Socia's car pulls out, I elect to do a diving spin move over the hood that I remember from the credit sequence of Starsky and Hutch. I calculate that Francis has rarely, if ever, watched TV, so he won't notice my blatant lift from my childhood heroes. I'm right.
"Hey, Rob, do that again," he says.
Cruz and I chase the Socias out of the alley over and over, maybe 15 takes each time. I begin to notice something about Tom that I will subsequently come to know well about certain actors. Although they are always prepared and ready, the second the camera rolls, they instinctively ramp up to a whole new level of intensity. Like bulls, when they see the color red, they are in a very special zone. After we rescue Ponyboy, we walk back to the house with all the others joining us in one long, uninterrupted shot, which is called a master. It's a lengthy scene, pages long. All of us have lines to deliver while we walk along and over a raised bed, which the camera is gliding around on, called a dolly track. Sometimes it's 2 feet off the ground, but you can't look like you're stepping over anything, which is an art that we will all become quite good at. As Matt Dillon's character Dallas arrives on the scene, I observe another phenomenon, the power of charisma. Matt is not revved up. He is not blazing like a Nova. He is relaxed and confident. He can just stand there and the camera loves him. I've watched actors on a set and they look just fine. Shifted my eyes to look at them on a monitor hooked up to a camera and suddenly they look amazing. Matt's one of those guys. Francis is really grinding us, but we love it. On The Outsiders, we will shoot a minimum of 12 takes to get a scene, maybe more. Often we do 20 to 30. To keep us energized and in the mood, not that we need it, he plays Elvis Presley's "I Want You, I Need You, I Love You" from giant speakers before every take. On any movie or TV show, you shoot a minimum of 12 hours a day. On movies, it's usually more like 13, and on The Outsiders, we would average 14 hours. So, at the end of day one, I'm tired, but exhilarated. This is early in all our careers, so we share tiny dressing rooms and cram together in vans to be driven home. On the ride back, I'm introduced to a tradition that I will come to embrace with tremendous gusto, the complimentary cooler full of beers. If, for some reason, you might not realize that the era of AOL Time Warner is different from those old days of working for the Brothers Warner, consider that they had no issue with a 15-year-old drinking beers on the clock. Being teenagers, we hoarded as many bottles as we could hide in our clothes after drinking as many as we could in the van. Later, we start the tradition of the greaser's caps drinking game back at the hotel. Like all else in my first movie, I'm learning how after hours are done in the big leagues. Work hard on the set, then play hard at the hotel. It takes an army to make a movie. Camera crews, lighting crews, wardrobe crews, makeup crews, hair crews, painters, builders called grips, a crew to provide the props, a crew to provide the furnishings, the art department, electricians, special effects people, stunt performers, stand-ins, accountants, scheduling and finance, called the unit production managers, catering, and someone to provide the snacks and drinks, called the craft service, and a team of walkie-talkie-armed Gestapo that police the second-by-second momentum of the shooting, the assistant director staff. But no one, and I mean no one, has more juice and is more loved or feared than the Teamsters. They come as advertised. They can make or break any production. You simply do not fuck with them. But in his typical fashion, Francis has other ideas. I'm crammed into my tiny trailer with Emilio, Cruz, and Howell when we hear Francis screaming at his longtime producer, Gray Fredrickson.
"Get rid of them! I want them gone!"
Francis, you can't fire the Teamsters, responds Gray evenly.
"Yes, we can! I want them gone! Today!"
yells Coppola, livid. "What's the deal?" I whisper to the guys. "I think it's about the budget," says Emilio, who knows these things. "Francis, if the Teamsters go, so do the cars, trucks, and trailers," argues Gray.
"I don't give a fuck!"
"But if the trailers go, then the actors have nowhere to change clothes or to keep warm or out of the rain."
"So what?"
"Well, they are all Screen Actors Guild members, and they are contractually provided with shelter."
"Well, fuck them too! I'll make this movie with University of Tulsa film students!" yells Francis.
Oh boy. Last week, we were worried about getting injured and being sent home. But this new scenario has us all really freaked. I look at Tommy Howell, who is wide-eyed.
I remember the Apocalypse Now documentary, where Francis is at least as concerned with continuing to shoot as he is with Martin Sheen's heart attack. I think to myself, this is one tough industry. Eventually, the director and producer move off, and we can no longer hear them. At lunchtime, the Teamsters, and our trailers, and ourselves, are still in place. At wrap, at the end of the day, it's like it never happened. Francis is back in his jovial, opera-listening mode, but I've seen how hairy it can get, and how quickly it can happen. I'm beginning to see that show business at this level is full of emotion, threats, and warlike conflict, usually followed by smiles and hugs. If you weren't crazy for wanting to get into movies in the first place, you could quickly become so once you got there. Chapter 11. Back at the hotel, I punched Tom Cruise in the face. I hit him squarely in the nose and hard. I see his eyes water and blink, so I know he's stunned and in pain. He goes into a rage and begins to pummel me mercilessly in the chest and ribs. It's getting way out of hand, and finally, Emilio and Tommy Howell step in to stop the fight. We've taken to these nightly sparring sessions in the sixth-floor hallway to kill time, blow off steam, and prepare for the upcoming rumble sequence in the movie. We wear headgear and mouthpieces, and the gloves are all pro-grade, all equipment provided by Emilio and Tom, the masters of fitness. Most of the time, it's pretty friendly, but every once in a while...
Hey, man, you okay? Says Cruz, coming back to reality.
I'm good. Sorry about the face shot, I say.
Well, now you know it'll happen if you do it again, he says, grinning his grin.
We high-five and begin to help the others pack up the equipment. Soon, we're planning our next session of R&R and a nightly flyby of the lobby to check out any potential girl activity. Since I first observed Matt Dillon's master's technique, I've been wondering how I might fare on my own. I've been dating Melissa Gilbert back in L.A., but her mom thinks I'm after her for her fame and won't let her visit me. I'm also beginning to feel the unique effects of shooting on location, a euphoric and toxic mix of excitement, boredom, anonymity, recognizability, and loneliness. After a few weeks of walking by the frenzied, available girls who look exactly like the cute girls at Sam Ojai who always ignore me, I'm ready to have some fun. And so begins a time-honored tradition of entertainers on the road. Sometimes you chase the girls, sometimes they chase you, literally. Sometimes it's just a flirt, and sometimes it's more than that. But it's always fun, and both principles in the equation seem to get exactly what they want out of it. We are all teenage boys, so you can imagine how enthusiastically we take to this pastime. Only Swayze, who is married, seems content to watch it all from the sidelines with a wry smile. For most of us greasers, it's a perfect setup. My situation is complicated somewhat by my long-distance relationship with my girlfriend, and there are times when I feel bad about that. But I begin to learn another great lesson. Nothing quiets the inner voice you want to ignore better than a couple of beers. And between the open cooler on the van ride home each day and Francis's food and wine festivals at the end of each week, I'm getting a lot of practice at quieting my conscience. You really know you've arrived in the movies when you're given your own stuntman. These are guys, or in our case, boys, who will take the blows and make you look like a stud. Even looking at your stuntman is a cool experience. He is dressed in your clothes, has the same haircut and style, and is your same weight and height. In essence, he is your tough, fearless doppelganger. Buddy Joe Hooker was, and is, the most legendary stuntman ever. A hit movie was made about him called Hooper, starring Burt Reynolds. He is the stunt coordinator on The Outsiders and will help Francis design all the car sequences, knifings, fights, and, of course, the big rumble between the Sochas and Greasers. He's dressed head to toe in white, including a cowboy hat, and is smoking a tiny cigar as he stands in the muddy, vacant lot that will be the set for the big brawl.
Hello, come meet your guy,
he says, gesturing to an exact replica of myself, a soda pop Curtis. This is Reed Rondell. He's one of my best, says Buddy Joe, who knows his stuff.